light and heat through. In another, it blocks some of the heat rays, another some of the light rays, and another both are blocked. The scientists at the Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory say such a tunable window could have a major impact on the consumption of fossil fuels by reducing the amount of air conditioning buildings require. The new research appears in the journal Nature. Joe Palca, NPR News, Washington.
It's now Tropical Storm Erin churning in the Atlantic. It was upgraded from a depression this morning after top sustained winds reached nearly 40 miles per hour. The National Hurricane Center in Miami says the storm is expected to get stronger over the next few days when it's over the warm waters southwest of the Cape Verde Islands. Erin is moving west-northwest at about 16 miles per hour. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Athena Health, working to help physicians manage change with cloud-based services plus Hippocrates mobile tools. AthenaHealth.com.
WILL programming is made possible by Sinfonia de Camera, introducing their 30th season with a gala celebration on Sunday, September 15th at 6 p.m. in the Krannert Center lobby. The evening will feature music, dancing, dinner, and a live auction. More information is available at the Sinfonia office at 244-4350.
Good morning and welcome to Focus. My name is Lisa Brault and I'm sitting in for Jim Meadows this hour. Today on the show, I'm talking with Jeannie Nolan. She's the author of a memoir, From the Ground Up, A Food Grower's Education in Life, Love, and the Movement That's Changing the Nation. It was published recently by Random House. She's also designed, installed, and still maintains the edible gardens at Lincoln Park Zoo in Chicago in partnership with the Green City Market, and is the founder of the Organic Gardener Limited, which works with households to develop gardens that are beautiful, productive, and uniquely suited to their homes and lifestyles. She lives with her husband, Verd, and their two daughters in Glencoe, Illinois. Do you grow your own food and maintain a garden? Why do you do it? And if you don't do it, what's holding you back? Give us a call today at 1-800-222-9455 and let us know how you feel about growing your own food. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu, or you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Focus 580. Jeannie Nolan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, I'm really happy to be here. Thank you.
So I want to start with the project that I actually recognize you from, which is the edible gardens at the Lincoln Park Zoo.
And
that's run by the Green City Market, or operated by the Green City Market in Chicago, which is a very large and very cool farmer's market. Can you describe to me what the market was like at that time when you first went there and got your first job there, and then how the edible gardens came from that?
Sure. Well, I was really fortunate to be introduced to a woman. She's no longer alive. Her name was Abby Mandel, who was the founder of Green City Market. She was very much the spearhead of bringing the local sustainable food movement to Chicago. And I began working with her as her assistant at the market to help her run it. And before she hired me, she said, well, go see the market. And I'd been living on a fairly isolated commune, and so this was new to me. I was really impressed by, the market itself and the difference it was making in Chicago. And then she had the idea that we together start a children's garden, a teaching garden, to teach kids where their food comes from, hands-on. And that was the idea with the edible gardens in the zoo.
So why, when you first put together this garden and you see the space, what are you thinking? Because you had this experience in the commune, and we'll go back to that shortly. But they give you this space. It's a large garden. It's about 5,000 square feet. Did you have a plan?
Well, my background growing food was more like organic farming, mm-hmm. so 1 to 3 acres kind of thing. And after that, I was growing in the suburbs in sort of small little gardens. So when I saw this space, I was like, oh, I can spread my wings here. I can do what I know how to do. It was very exciting for me. And there's something kind of fun and ironic about it, a farm in the zoo in the city. It's kind of a staged farm, petting zoo sort of a situation. But I loved it right away. And also, I think that I began to experience immediately, once I was growing food in the space, the impact it was having on families, on kids, on visitors to Chicago and Chicagoans alike. Getting their hands dirty and growing food right there in the city was obviously really important to them. So super rewarding right away.
Can you talk about some of the experiences you had with children there? In your
sure.
memoir, you talk about several kids and the impact that the garden had on them. And if you want to share those anecdotes or different ones, I'd love to hear them.
Yeah, I mean, you know, nearest and dearest to my heart is Tommy. And Tommy started coming to our garden in Lincoln Park Zoo when he was 4 years old. And we had opened, we were just getting the soil ready and planting, and he would come every Saturday with his dad, Tom. And Tommy was an incredibly focused kid. Nothing would distract him. You know, harvesting, planting, munching everything, not afraid of the dirt, interested in bugs, asking the best questions, totally attentive. His dad, of course, was like, well, we're at the zoo. Let's go see the elephants. Let's go see the giraffes. And Tommy was like, no way. I'm into the vegetables. So that's where he stayed. And about his fourth visit, he shows up with a very large pair of headphones on. And I looked at his dad kind of like, huh? Is he listening to music? Like, I couldn't figure it out. And his dad sort of brought me aside and quietly let me know that Tommy was in the process of being diagnosed with having ADHD, that he had some serious focus issues, that he was a real challenge both in school and at home. And he was just coming from occupational therapy, and he needed to leave the headphones on for another 20 minutes. I mean, my jaw could have hit the floor. Mm-hmm. This kid, Tommy, the most attentive, focused, well-behaved, able to garden for over an hour, has ADHD? It just did not make sense to me. And since then, in the process of writing my book, we did a lot of research and really found out that there are numerous studies done at universities proving that, especially for kids with focus issues, being outdoors in an outdoor classroom setting, growing food, getting the hands in the dirt, learning through doing, is a gateway to the best of them. They really are able to focus. And, the inattentiveness, the impulsivity is vastly reduced. So that's just one of the ways that growing food, there's more than meets the eye there. You know, it tastes delicious when you grow your own food. It's more nutrient dense. But there's this whole other world of sort of benefits, really. Waiting for people. And Tommy reaped those benefits, and his family then went on to put a garden at his school, and then at their home. And I just had a book signing, and Tommy's now 12, and he came, and he asked the best questions.
Oh, excellent.
So...
So if you're listening and you have questions or comments for Jeannie Nolan, if you grow food with your kids in your garden, if you have an experience that you'd like to share, give us a call at 1-800-222-9455. You can send us an email at will-talk@illinois.edu, or you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Focus 580. So we've been talking about your work in the edible gardens and working with kids, and now I want to talk about you as a kid a little bit. So we're going to go back to some history here. Can you tell me a little bit about where and when you grew up? Because
sure.
I think the when is actually as important as the where
after
reading the book.
Yeah, I think you're right. So I was born in 1968, and I grew up in a town called Winnetka, which is part of the North Shore, a series of suburbs, very affluent suburbs, north of Chicago. Doctors, lawyers, realtors, business investors who made the half-hour commute into Chicago to work, and basically the American dream plus was going on there.
Mm-hmm.
So when I was in high school, 1985, mid-80s, I'd been a very good girl growing up, but towards the end of high school, I really began to question things. Materialism, the focus on money is the way to happiness, and I began the search for me, so to speak.
When you were a young child, were you interested in the environment at all? Did any of these things that you work with now, did any of them sort of crop up for you, no pun intended. Did they crop up for you when you were a child at all?
Well, I didn't spend time growing food. I had one incident where I wandered into a neighbor's vegetable garden and had sort of one of these amazing 10-year-old moments where I'm, you know, I'm lying on the ground and I'm looking up at this dome of a vegetable garden over me, and I picked a cucumber and I ate it, and it really blew my mind. It was very peaceful, and that was a special experience that impacted me. And then I was really lucky. I spent my summers at a wonderful girls' summer camp in northern Wisconsin, mm-hmm. and 7 summers, and there was a lot of love of nature going on there, and that impacted me, you know, really profoundly, the sense that we were connected to the natural world and that the natural world needed to be cared for by people.
So when you were at camp, was it hard to come home?
Oh, it was so hard to come home. You know, one time my mom reminded me later in life that I was crying to her coming home from camp saying, "It's not right the way we live, Mom, with TV and, you know, cars and everybody's so busy and it's not natural." So it was a rough change for me. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So you enter adolescence and it gets a little rocky, and a young man was particularly influential for you, and so you know, you alluded to sort of rebelling against some of the things that you were seeing around you in your neighborhood. How influential was that person, and maybe the time you and I share, we're the same age. We both grew up in the 80s, and so I kind of know it, and I grew up in the suburbs of another city. So how influential was this person and time and where you were in your decision to eventually renounce at that time the way that your family lived and your environment?
Yeah, so his name was Mark, and I met him at the end of my sophomore year. And, you know, he was in the same year in high school that I was. And he was totally different than anyone I had met. He read, you know, Thoreau and Hermann Hesse. And it was sort of that, like, questioning everything, looking for why we were alive, you know, aware of the environment. And it totally changed my perspective. I mean, he was talking and thinking about things that had never occurred to me, but somehow made a lot of sense to me. And we spent a lot of time outdoors, you know, in all the forest preserves and parks and prairie areas around where I grew up, and it just opened my eyes to a totally different way of thinking that was very against my parents and the world I'd grown up in. So he was hugely influential on my decisions and my life's path.
So were your parents confused by this?
Oh, agony. I mean, we are talking beyond confused. This made absolutely no sense. I mean, you know, I just came off a semester of visiting, like, what do they call the schools? The Little Ivies, like every mm-hmm. Little Ivy school known to man with my dad. You know, which one was I going to? You know, Williams or Wesleyan? And then I broke the news to them, I don't want to go to college. I'm dropping out of high school, and I want to move into my boyfriend's house. You know, I mean, this was, you know, my parents had gone to the same high school that I went to, New Trier High School outside of Chicago, and I was smarter than them. I mean, this just didn't make sense, but there we were, stuck in it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my parents really rose to the occasion. They really parented extraordinarily through this, and we navigated it together. You know, there were some of those things that they couldn't stop me from doing, and there were others where we made some compromises. Mm-hmm. But it was a very difficult time.
So what eventually triggered your interest? You know, you've talked about experiences where you were more in touch with nature and the natural world. What triggered your interest in local and organic food?
So with my boyfriend, Mark, we fled the suburbs we grew up in, and we headed west. We did a lot of camping out in New Mexico and Arizona, and eventually settled in Flagstaff, Arizona. I got a job as a waitress and we just hiked and backpacked as much as we could, sort of searching for a different way to live. Mm-hmm. In the town of Flagstaff, I wandered into a very little health food store, the first one I'd ever been into. And keep in mind, this was 1987. Maybe there were a couple of Whole Foods, small Whole Foods down in Texas. You know, this was not the times we're in now. And I walked in, and I saw a sign for organic apples and produce. And I walked over to the storekeeper and said, "Excuse me, what does organic mean?" And you know, in real simple language, the person said to me, "It means this food was grown without chemicals." And it was like a light bulb went off in my head. "You mean everything I've ever eaten was grown with chemicals?" I couldn't even believe it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was in that moment that all of my angsting about, you know, deforestation and species extinction and, you know, air pollution and, oh, well, there's got to be a better way to live. I want to change the world. It really sort of galvanized around, oh, food. I could learn how to grow food without chemicals. And that's when I decided that's what I wanted to do. And came home after journeying west and talked to my parents about it. And things led from there. My mom helped me find an apprenticeship on a farm that was also a commune. And that's how I launched into learning to grow food.
And that Zendik farm you're talking about?
Exactly.
So you get there, and your mom had helped you, and you went off with your parents' blessing. How old were you at the time?
I was 18.
You were 18. Mm-hmm. So when you get there, mm-hmm. and where was it located at that time?
So when I went to the commune, Zendik Farm, it was east of San Diego, about 75 miles. So it was in the high desert, right on the Mexican border. Very sort of shrubby, boulder-strewn, very beautiful, very dramatic. Not a place you would really think that you'd be growing great organic vegetables. The commune had worked the soil so well that right there in the high desert, we grew a field of corn that looked like Iowa. I mean, amazing. really good farming practices going on there.
Did you take to the farming tasks right away? You know, this is something that you decided you wanted to do. So when you got there, had you really sort of found your place, do you think?
Yeah.
It felt like
it was immediate. You know, that first day, one of the women brought me out to the main field where the food was being grown, and there was a stand of sugar snap peas. And I remember we walked by, and I said, "Those look ready to harvest. Can I harvest those?" And the woman said to me, "Oh, I think you're going to be good at this." You know, I don't know. I was tuned in. I was interested.
And was there anything on the farm as you got through, as you started learning all the different tasks on the farm, was there anything you didn't like doing?
Well, I mean, some of it was a little raunchy. You know, in California, because it was so dry, we composted. We made compost in pits. So these were like 4 or 5 feet deep, maybe like 8 by 16. So you would stand in the pit and turn the compost. So this was barn muckings, food waste. Pretty funky. But you know what? I enjoyed it. I just got into it.
It was probably no one's favorite job, I'm guessing. Favorite job, but...
Right. You know, but I was learning how compost was made. And So I enjoyed the hard work of it. I really did. I mean, even you know, butchering chickens and things I'd never done before. I enjoyed it.
Did you feel like you were establishing more of a personal relationship with food in this way, working with it so closely? Is that something you were seeking to do for yourself at that time?
Yeah. I mean, I think that I was seeking to do something basic, real, sort of, you know, A to B. You do this, you get this. And food is so essential that it just made sense to me. It just felt right to spend my day producing it and preparing it and then, you know, eating it with the group of people who had grown it. it just resonated with me on a basic level.
So let's talk. You mentioned eating with other people and working with other people. So let's talk about the communal aspect of where you were. I think a lot of people have an idea of what they think living on a commune is like or would be like. There are certain stereotypes that have been perpetuated for a long time. Did you have any stereotypes in mind, and did your life there live up to your expectations at first?
Well, I had wanted to live on a commune. I liked the idea of living with a group of people with shared ideals. And most of it was really fantastic. But there was enough of it that wasn't. That in the end, after 17 years, there were a lot of reasons to leave. Mm-hmm. But some of that was a bit apparent at first. You know, it wasn't 100% perfect fit, but mostly it was pretty great.
Okay, we do have a caller, and it's Jeff from Geneva. He gardens with his family, and he is on the line. Jeff from in Geneva.
Hey, good morning, guys, or gals.
Hi.
I love the gardening stuff. The problem is around here, and I grew up out west in the southwest in the desert in Lancaster, so I know what you're talking about. Since I've lived out here, it's kind of hard to grow anything in a winter time, and I'm trying to figure out a way where I can grow my own tomatoes and peppers in a winter, because the prices of everything go up through the roof around here, and there's got to be a way, you know, where you could do this. And besides, I have a garden out here that I try to grow as much as I can. Unfortunately, you know, the bugs and stuff get to it, and I'm trying to, it's a nightmare. I'm trying not to use chemicals to fight off some of the worms and crickets and whatnot. I thought maybe since you lived in a commune, what they used to use natural, because I'm trying to stay natural, and it's virtually, to me, almost impossible without using something.
Right. Well, you know, there's a few basic things that help reduce the nastiness of the bugs. One of them is really preparing your soil well. It doesn't totally get rid of them, but it does help, adding a lot of compost to the soil and making sure that your soil is deeply aerated. You can also plant a lot of different crops, including flowers, in the vicinity of each other, and try to attract some of the good insects that'll prey on the bad bugs. I don't know if you've tried either of those things. And there are some certified organic pesticides, real bug killers, that you can use. There's a great catalog called Johnny's Selected Seeds where they sell these things. So if you've tried everything you can and you're just still getting overrun by bad bugs, there are things that you can do that are naturally derived, but will get rid of them. So you can also look into that.
Okay, well, I've wrote it down, and I'll try and check it out. I live close to the Illinois Extension, so I should.
They'd be a great resource for you.
Appreciate the show, guys. Thank you very much.
Yeah, sure.
Happy gardening.
Thanks, Jeff. Okay, I'm Lisa Braltz. We're going to take a short break here. I'm talking this hour with Jeannie Nolan. She works with the Edible Gardens at the Lincoln Park Zoo in Chicago with the Green City Market and is the author of the new book, From the Ground Up, A Food Grower's Education in Life, Love, and the Movement That's Changing a Nation. This is Focus on WILL AM 580.
What's going on in your brain while you sleep, and how can you make sure you get the sleep you need? On the next Fresh Air, we talk with neuroscientist Penelope Lewis, author of The Secret World of Sleep. She runs the Sleep and Memory Lab at the University of Manchester in England. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Support for today's broadcast comes in part from the Friends of WILL and from Wesley Church and Wesley Foundation, welcoming students, faculty, and staff on the corner of Goodwin and Green. Services Sunday at 9:30 and 11:15 a.m. Details at wesleyui.org.
Welcome back to Focus. I'm Lisa Braltz. This hour, I'm talking with Jeannie Nolan. She's a food grower and author of the new memoir, From the Ground Up. Jeannie, before the break and before the caller that we had, we were talking about your experience at Zendik Farm. And I want to talk a little bit about some of the trials that you experienced while you were there, and then what your relationship was like with your family while you were there.
Sure. So, you know, over the course of the 17 years that I lived on this commune, you know, I saw my parents fairly frequently, usually 2-3 times a year. Short visits, either I'd come to them or they'd come to me, but I was always kept myself very removed from them. The attitude on the commune was very kind of superior, like we were living this very pure, eco-friendly, sustainable lifestyle, and the rest of the world had it wrong. And that included my parents and the entire world I came from. So it's pretty hard to get close to anybody when you've got that attitude. Mm-hmm. And you know, I really joined the commune in that shared attitude of being removed and sort of looking down at mainstream society as a mm-hmm. failure. Mm-hmm. You know, the idea was that we were living by example. We would show the world a way to live more in balance with the earth. And I see now so much about that was delusional, but at the time, you know, it really was my perspective.
So a lot can happen in 17 years, and you made the decision to leave. When you left home, you were 18 years old. When you came back 17 years later, you went back to your childhood home. You had a daughter.
Mm-hmm.
What was that experience like for you? And then I want you to talk a little bit about the garden that you planted in your parents' backyard.
Sure. So my daughter, Sia, was 2.5 or so when we left the commune, and it was all she had known till then. And, you know, when we got to my parents' house outside of Chicago, you know, we got there and we got settled in and sat down to have dinner, and she said, "Well, where is everybody?" You know, she was used to eating meals with 35 people. It was the first meal in her life she'd eaten with 4 people. So it was a big transition for both of us. You know, immediately being with my parents, you know, I was in a total low point of my life. Mm-hmm. Everything was not going well. You know, I wasn't parenting well. My headspace was awful. I had no idea what I was doing with my life. This thing I had believed in for 17 years no longer held water. And I was back in the suburbs as a single mom. And my parents were there for me. They took us in. And, you know, my mom had the idea in response to the fact that, you know, I was really just looking for something to do. I was used to being very busy, very physically active. And my mom had the idea, why don't you put a garden in our backyard? And I said, sounds good. So we set about making a garden, and it was about 10 feet by 14 feet. And, you know, I was used to growing 300 tomato plants, not 6. But the garden was a very healing thing for Thea and myself and my family, and ultimately was sort of the turning point, you know, where I launched myself out of this low point into the next phase of my life, a very, very positive phase. Mm-hmm. So the garden was a great thing.
Listeners, if you have questions or comments about growing food or why you don't grow food, call us at 1-800-222-9455. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu, or you can find us via social media, Facebook and Twitter, at Focus580. But your parents, your mom, encouraging you to garden, this is not something that typically happened in your parents' neighborhood. These neighborhoods did not have, they had very landscaped and manicured gardens, but they were not food gardens. Is that right?
Oh, for sure.
So she was kind of putting herself out there a little bit by letting
you
do that.
She was. She absolutely was. You know, she was doing what she does best. She was tuning into me and what I needed. You know, I mean, we did our best to make the garden look charming and look like it fit into their yard and their neighborhood. We put a white picket fence around it. We planted beautiful sunflowers and flowers in it. So it really was pretty, but it was a food garden and not what you typically see in that area. You're right.
What was the reaction of the neighbors?
They loved it. Mm-hmm. Everybody who came over was blown away. And it was two close friends of mine that I'd grown up with who came by and said to me, Jeannie, do you realize how amazing this is? You should start a business. People are going to want you to help them do this. Times have changed. You know, Winnetka isn't the same place it was when you left. There's a growing environmental consciousness. People want to be green. And you should help people grow food. I hadn't even thought of it. It hadn't even occurred to me.
One thing that you said in the book that struck me was, you know, a lot of these people were already accessing at the time. This is the mid-2000s, right? This is around 2004, I think.
Correct. You got
and,
it.
And so a lot of people are already accessing this kind of food in the neighborhood where your parents' home was by going to stores. And you sort of hit on the concept of instead of going and accessing it that way, you hit on the concept of bringing it to them and having it there in your own backyard. You talk about doing it yard by yard, which is something I can really get behind. So is that concept something that really kept you going? I mean, it is an unusual idea for a business. I mean, a lot of people hire landscapers and people to come and take care of their yards that way. But how hard was it to get started and where did you get help and inspiration from?
When I first had the idea, you know, my dad gave me good advice, and he said, well, nobody's running a business exactly like yours, but why don't you go meet with a landscaper who is in a similar industry and find out how they structure their business? So that was really helpful, having that meeting. Mm-hmm. And I knew that I wanted to help families incorporate growing food in their lifestyle. So I didn't want to just do this sort of as a service. I wanted to do it as an educational experience for the family. I wanted to work with the kids, work with the parents, to help them learn how to do this. And immediately, I started making the most fantastic relationships with people around growing food together, you know, really, really relating. And I would bring Thea with me, and their kids would be out there. And, you know, so the first year I put up a flyer. I got 20 phone calls and 12 clients, and I was up and running. You know, the second year, Verd, who's now my husband, joined me with a very good friend of ours from the commune. And, you know, we're now in our ninth season. So we've been doing this a long time. We've planted over 650 urban farms and food gardens at this point in and around Chicago. But, you know, in the first year, I was really just figuring out the basics. You know, where am I going to put my tools? You know, I got a top carrier to put on top of my station wagon that would hold my rake and my shovel.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me, sorry.
It's okay.
So, you know, the business has grown over the years a lot, but it's never strayed from the desire to help people learn where their food grows from right in their own backyard.
So the clients that you work with, I was struck by some of the differences. It seems like some of them are really sort of sleeves up, hands dirty types. They're right out there with you, lots of energy. And then some of them seemed a little more standoffish, but standing to the side and sort of letting you know, you and the people that you work with do the work. Do you have any good anecdotes you'd like to share about some of your clients? My favorite was the guy who very politely told you to plant a garden in the shade. And, you know, like he pretty much insisted that that was
right.
How it was going to be done. That was my favorite. But you had some other really interesting clients as well.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's a learning curve, I think, for every entrepreneur. And part of my learning curve was really realizing that I knew how to do this. So the one you're talking about, this client who insisted that a spot that was actually very shady had plenty of sun for a garden, you know, now I would know to say, it's not going to work. I won't grow your garden there. But I just wasn't that strong at the time,
right.
So I planted his garden there, and nothing grew, and I had to, apologize nicely and not charge him his second half, and that was that. But I learned that one the hard way. Some other stories, another woman who wanted to plant her garden right between two trees. Well, you know, again, all the leafy greens did well, but none of the root crops thrived because there was no soil. There wasn't enough soil for them to grow in. Now I would know to say, no, I won't put your garden there. So I think sometimes, you know, the best way to learn is by making mistakes and learning the hard way. And gardening, definitely, that is part of the process, no matter how good you are at it.
If you're listening and you have questions or comments for our guest, Jeannie Nolan, give us a call at 1-800-222-9455. You can send us an email at will-talk@illinois.edu, or you can find us on Facebook and Twitter and contact us that way, at Focus 580. I'd like to talk a little bit about the gardening season, the actual work of gardening. Can you describe the arc of a gardening season for you?
Sure. So in our area, we hope to start preparing soil, getting the garden ready, sometime in March. There are years when it warms up early March and we can get going, and then there are years like this year where, I mean, I think there was snow on the ground into April.
Mm-hmm.
We got a very late start this year.
We did too.
Yeah, and that was very difficult. But as soon as we can work the earth, we work it. And then we start planting. At the latest, we try to get our first seeds and plants in the ground middle of April. And those are the cold weather crops, the crops that will thrive and germinate in cool weather. Peas and broccoli and lettuce and spinach and radishes, all kinds of greens, carrots, beets do great then. Then we wait for it to warm up. So that the crops that need hot weather to grow and thrive, the ones that get our mouths watering, tomatoes, peppers, eggplant, basil, cucumbers, those need soil and air temperatures to be pretty warm. That's typically mid-May or later. Some people don't even put those in till early June. So that's when we get those in the ground. And from then on, through, I'd say, September, it's a process of tending, harvesting, and when certain plants are finished and come out of the ground, you can just plant something else. And that sort of rotates what you plant.
Mm-hmm.
Then September, October, November, we're into harvesting fall crops like Brussels sprouts and butternut squash and kale. And usually our gardens are put to bed around Thanksgiving. We do have some families that we work with where we use a cold frame that's like a mini greenhouse that goes over a raised bed or over the ground, and that helps us extend the season. So that can protect greens throughout the winter and enable you to, eat some spinach through the winter, some other greens, and then early spring start eating those again. But not all of our families use cold frames. I mean, you know, going to Thanksgiving for a lot of people is plenty long.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of the flow of our season.
One thing that made me laugh as I was reading was the concept, I believe it was your husband and one of your colleagues, of the 100 days of hell. What is that?
So, you know, my husband and I run our business together. So the 100 days of hell is the peak of our season. We're talking March, April, May, and June. And that is basically when we work almost nonstop because we have to make our nut in a very short amount of time, acquire new clients, plant 100-plus gardens, And we've got a lot going on in that period of time. So our whole family kind of hunkers down and handles it. And thankfully, you know, my sister helps, my parents help. My kids have different dads. The dads are all on deck. You know, we're all doing what we can, you know, to get through it. But 100 days of hell because all we do is think, eat, breathe gardens and making them succeed.
It's great to have that support network, though, I think.
It is.
Without that, I think it would be even tougher, than more hellish than it already is.
Absolutely. And we make it fun. You know, our kids know by now. Doesn't last forever, you know, and they, you know, they can participate in some of it too. So
part of your job too, I think, especially with regards to edible gardens, as you've sort of branched out in the last 9 years, you've become a sought after speaker and instructor. And is that something that you ever thought you'd do? And can you also talk a little bit about the five principles of gardening that you do bring to audiences when you're talking to them?
Sure. So, you know, when I was a little girl, one of the things I used to fantasize being was a newscaster on TV. Sounds crazy.
Not at all.
I always have really liked public speaking and speaking in front of groups of people. But I never really kind of found my groove of how to make that be part of what I did in a way that worked. So now that I am teaching to all kinds of different groups of people, you know, and speaking about how to grow food and why grow food, and now my personal journey, being an entrepreneur, I love it. I absolutely love it. And, you know, the five keys to setting up and growing a successful food garden are, number one, sun. Ideally, you want 6 to 8-plus hours of sun, the more the better. Soil, the fantasy soil for an organic gardener, is 12 to 18 inches deep, well aerated, nutrient dense, lots of compost in their soil. Third key to success is paths. You want to have well-defined walking paths. The human body compresses the soil. And once you work so hard to make it light and fluffy, you do not want to walk on top of it.
Mm-hmm.
It also makes it so much easier when you're gardening with kids to say, you know, there's the straw path or the wood chip path. That's where you walk. And you just don't put your feet here where the food's growing. Much more fun with defined paths with kids.
Mm-hmm.
Fourth key to success, irrigation. You need to have a plan for how your garden is going to get watered. Some people use a battery-operated timer on their spigot that turns on a system that conserves water and just puts the water right at the roots of the veggies through a series of drip-line tubes. Great way to grow. And there are a lot of do-it-yourself kits out there for this.
Mm-hmm.
Fifth key to success is fencing. One rabbit in your garden can wreck the whole thing. And my message with fencing is it doesn't just have to be rusty chicken wire and metal posts.
Mm-hmm.
You could make it attractive and rabbit-proof or deer-proof, whatever you need. But a good fence, you know, a lot of people try to avoid it, but in almost all situations, you're going to need some kind of a fence. So those are my five keys to setting up a garden that's going to be fun to work in and that's going to succeed for you.
Take note, everybody. We're coming up toward the end of the program, but we still have a few minutes left. If you have questions or comments for our guest, Jeannie Nolan, please give us a call. 1-800-222-9455 is the number to call. You can send us an email at will-talk@illinois.edu, or you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Focus580. I want to take a couple of minutes to talk about some of the recent projects you've become involved with outside of your business in edible gardens, like Solid Ground. Are you trying to do more work with people who live in much more urban environments without necessarily the means or access to land and resources of your suburban customers?
You know, I am very interested in that. You know, basically, if an organization or an individual comes to me and they have a project and they want help with it, I'm going to want to help. And more and more, We are being approached by gardens that are one of the solutions to the issue of food deserts in our country, these vast areas and cities where there is not easy access to healthy, fresh food. And, you know, Michelle Obama has done so much to, you know, convey the power of gardening with children on the eating habits and health habits, you know, of our nation's kids. So more and more organizations are wanting to implement programs to, you know, put those ideas into action, and I love working on them. One of them has been this shelter for young men, a homeless shelter in Humboldt Park in Chicago, and it's just been such a joy to work with these guys. They're age 18 to 22, and they get to live there at solid ground, it's called, for 2 years, and rebuild their lives. And part of what they do there is decide what they want to grow, plant the garden, harvest, and make good food. And it's an important part of having a roof over your head. So that's been really rewarding.
We do have a caller. Tara is on line 4. She's calling from the road. Go ahead, Tara.
Hi, Jeannie. Thanks so much for writing your book and sharing your journey. My question is about the kids and the kids who are now at those houses where you're growing food in their own backyard. How are they reacting to that food? Are they now knowing what is real food, and are they helping to re-educate their parents and their classmates? And is this a way to get people to know that, you know, Coke and a quarter pounder isn't real food, and that, you know, cabbage and carrots and, you know, sweet potatoes from your own backyard are real food, and that there's a huge difference between what you grow yourself and what you buy in the store?
That's a great question, and I do think that it makes an enormous difference, and parents don't always realize that it is making a difference. For instance, there's a family that I've worked with for 8 years growing a food garden, and they had 3 kids, and the mom would literally have to say, it's Mother's Day, you have to plant with me, and make her kids work with her. They were not thrilled. So her one son is heading off to college, and makes 2 statements. Number one, he wants to spend his summers working with our company, growing food gardens, because that's what he cares about. Number two, he wants to go to a college where they have an urban farming program. So this kid wasn't necessarily embracing the garden his whole childhood, but it's clearly having a huge impact on his decisions as a young adult and what he wants to do with his life. So, you know, I think that it's pretty profound when homegrown food shows up on the table at dinner time over and over again. You know, a lot of studies show kids who grow vegetables at home or at school eat more vegetables, and that's definitely for sure. So on a lot of levels, you know, better citizens for the earth, more of a consciousness to take care of the planet, and better eaters, you know, kids who understand the joys of eating healthy food. Definitely, this is effective.
Yeah, well, thanks for making a difference and for, you know, getting the next generation back on track with real food. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for calling, Tara.
Thanks, Tara. Jeannie, do you ever wonder, speaking of kids and teenagers, maybe as your daughters get a little bit older, do you ever wonder what your daughter's teenage years are going to bring in terms of their involvement with growing food? I mean, it's not just as simple as having a garden in their parents' backyard. This is like immersion living that they've been a part of. Is that something you wonder about as your daughters get a little bit older?
It is. So Thea, my older daughter, is entering 7th grade, and Kisten, our younger one, is entering kindergarten. Kisten is going to have the pleasure of right now at her preschool, and in all the public schools she will go through in our town in Glencoe, our company has put a vegetable garden in. So all of her schools are going to have gardens that her parents built. So that's fun, and she'll be participating in those. You know, but as a parent of a 12-year-old young woman, I'm trying to look at her and let her be who she wants to be. You know, when I say to her, let's spend a mommy-daughter day, and I'm thinking, we'll garden, we'll go for a bike ride in the woods, and she says, let's go to Chicago and go shopping. I say, yeah, let's do it. Let's go. You know, I'm I need to meet her where she is, but at the same time, I am thrilled when she has friends over and every time they end up in the garden harvesting and munching. So, you know, we'll see where this goes. I don't know. I mean, she's made it quite clear she will not be running the organic gardener.
I have a question about cost, too. You know, gardening, it can be a little intimidating, I think, for families or households or individuals of modest means or even less than modest means. What's your advice quickly to gardeners who are a little intimidated? You know, maybe they have to use that rusty chicken wire to get going. That shouldn't be an obstacle.
Absolutely. I mean, there, you know, you can garden fancy or you can garden basic. And all my years farming, it was very basic. And the National Gardening Association did a fascinating study where they found out that the average family with a vegetable garden spends $70 a year growing their garden and grows $600 worth of veggies. So if you keep it simple and, you know, just do what's got to be done to get growing that food, it can be a real, wallet helper for sure.
And that's assuming that they have access to land in a yard. There could be community gardening fees. Container gardening can be a little more of an initial expense in terms of outlay up front, right?
Absolutely. You're right. I mean, you know, a lot of people in the city, you can make a self-watering container using 5-gallon buckets. You know, there are some really neat things online, gardening on the cheap methods that really work well. So it's all, how you go at it.
Mm-hmm. So we're going to have to wrap it up here pretty quickly. And I have a big question to ask you. Your book's title describes this as the movement that's changing a nation. Do you still think it's changing a nation? Are we making progress?
Oh, I think we're making tons of progress. I think of this movement as the seed-to-table movement, the movement of people wanting to be involved in, what happens to their food from seed to table. It is gaining more and more momentum nationally. It is not going away. And it's very exciting to see, where we're going here. In Chicago in 2010, there were 60 acres of food being grown within the city limits. By 2012, it had increased 50%. That's in vacant lots and people's backyards. So this is a movement of people, and it's happening because so many of us are looking for an action to take. There is a lot to be dissatisfied about in our world. There is a lot to change, and growing food is something that we can do to make a difference. Eating habits, climate change, on and on. It's very exciting.
We'll have to wrap it up there. Jeannie, thank you. I could ask you so many more questions. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
I'm Lisa Brault, sitting in this hour for Jim Meadows. I've been talking with Jeannie Nolan, food grower and author of From the Ground Up. You can find out more about her and her book by visiting our website at will.illinois.edu/focus. Coming up tomorrow on the show, Jim Meadows will talk with personal finance expert Kevin Waspy and UIUC Extension Personal Finance Education educator Kathy Swedler. Today's show was produced by Lindsay Moon. Jason Croft is our technical director. I'm Lisa Brault, and you've been listening to Focus on WILL. Thanks for joining us.
Support for WILL comes from Bates Commodities, AgriGold, The Andersons, Wisconsin Plastic Drain and Tile, Strategic Farm Marketing, and Farm Credit Services. Thanks to these businesses for their support of WILL agricultural programs.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the agricultural markets, where we're seeing double-digit increases in both the corn and soybean futures pits. A drier forecast and warmer temperatures next week has perked this market to the upside, as well as export sales. USDA this morning reporting next year export sales for soybeans at 69.6 million bushels and for corn at 32.9 million. Let's look and see how futures currently are trading. Hard red winter wheat for December, 707, up 4. December soft wheat, 640. $4.49, up 6.25. September corn, 4.76¾, up 12. And December at 4.69½, up 14.25. It's been high today as 4.75½. September beans, 12.85½, up 16. November, 12.58¾, up 19¾. September soybean meal, 4.13.70, up 5.80. September soybean oil, 42.96, up 62. August live cattle, 123.55, down 45. And October lean hogs, 87.30, down 85. You're listening to Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3 Urbana. It's 11 o'clock Central Time.